shack desktop looks like during a technical met. I have it plastered with all kinds of open windows, letting me know how everything is going across and coming back to me and such. So, you know, I appreciate all the computer-based algorithms and the new modes that computerization has offered us. People love CW. God bless them. People love FT8. God bless them. It doesn't take anything off of my enjoyment if they have more options than they had before. So the more options, the better, in my personal opinion.
USL, QSL. But how to say, you know, to each his own, to each his own. And I tried FT8, it was just okay. And I played with All Star. And that was okay too. I have some communication I need to make on All Star. And I just set up my ICOM IC718, and it sounds really good compared to the other radio. But there's so much noise on 40 meters. So, but I think that ham radio is an amazing hobby. And like you say, bless each person for what they want to do.
Yeah, I see nothing wrong with it. I am not the guy, I hope I never become a guy who sits there with the clipboard saying, this is ham radio, this isn't ham radio, this is ham radio, that isn't ham radio. Yeah, if you're having fun, so be it. Do whatever you want to do, as long as you don't frighten the horses, as the old saying went. By the way, David, as you started your transmission, there was someone else who doubled with you, so let's see if we can find out who that might be.
Yeah, I believe that was me again, Roy, WB2BX.
Oh, okay, Frank, well, what did you want to say?
Yeah, I think the confusion, and it's my fault for not researching it first, is that it sounds like the CW skimmer is the underlying technology under the reverse beacon network. That's how they do it, in other words, is skim all those frequencies at once to find all those call signs that are posted on the packet clusters, another confusing term. You know, the sites like DX Central, and anyway, the site, by going on RBN, you'll see all the DX clusters. I don't think they really call them packet clusters anymore, because very few of them are probably still are still on VHF packet. But anyway, that's how they're gathering the data, is with the CW skimmers. That's the underlying technology. Just like VOIP is the underlying technology beneath All-Star and Echolink and many other things we use. Go ahead.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, it's sort of, you know, how you make the sausage type of things. People availing themselves of this method don't really need to know how they're extracting the call signs from the audio signals. But it's a nice piece of software. I especially used to like to run it during contests, because then you have a ridiculous number of guys right next to each other on the CW portion of the band. And it always amazed me how it was able to decode them. Usually, unfortunately, if the guy had a real clean fist or if he was using a keyer, it wasn't that much of a problem. But I would bump into these guys with kind of sloppy fists, and the algorithms just couldn't finesse it. So I'm always hoping that they'll get a little bit better. The guy who did the CW skimmer, I think, moved on. I think he was interested in building a similar thing for Riddy. So I don't think he's gone back to the algorithms and tweaked them in 10 years or so. But it's a fine piece of software. You got to pay for it to get it to work over a long time, but it was worth the money for me, at least.
Yeah. Yeah, who was the guy who did the CW skimmer? Do you recall who that is, Gad?
No, unfortunately, I don't remember his name. It took me a while to memorize poor Joe Taylor's name, and that's a real simple name because, you know, he's I'm always discussing FT8 or Whisper or some other aspect. And although the guy who did CW Skimmer does very good software, I do not recall his name. It could be Googled. You know, there's a lot on CW Skimmer. There's even a Wikipedia entry on the subject. So it's something that you can do. It's just I haven't done it in a long time.
Yeah, I remember when I got my first packet controller, PK-80 and then a PK-232, and looked in the manual and saw the call sign of a guy who I grew up with here in Brooklyn, and was surprised to find that he had a role in inventing all that stuff. I don't remember whether he's kind of modest. It's entirely possible it's one of the technologies he worked on also, and I'll have to look it up and see. Go ahead with the Netroid, WB2BX. I don't think I hung the repeater. I think something else weird happened. WB2BX.
Okay, I'll try one more time. Every so often, this All-Star thing doesn't click very well, but most of the time it does. I found the guy. He's called Alex Shovkai Pius. He's VE3NEA.
Oh, okay. He's not one of the guys I know. I think I've heard the name, of course. Yeah, that's interesting. This is crazy stuff. It's kind of amazing some of the hybrid stuff we can do between ham radio and the internet and all these technologies. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, there's some people who always kind of feel threatened by new technology, that, you know, people will abandon their old technology and such. But the more the merrier, in my humble opinion.
Yeah, I think it would be interesting to see all of the possibilities. People can engage in all of them.
Well, yeah, but it'd be kind of difficult to kind of do that. I mean, you could build the stuff into software that people who like to remain anonymous wouldn't appreciate. That goes back to Daddy and announces that someone has used such and such the algorithm. But otherwise, though, it's kind of difficult to do that. I mean, it would be kind of interesting to know how many people are listening versus how many people are talking on the TechNet, but that's kind of an invasion of privacy, I think.
Well, what about artificial intelligence? The whole sunspot cycle, the whole bazaar of ham radio in artificial intelligence.
What about artificial intelligence? You have to understand that right now artificial intelligence is kind of a very sophisticated party trick. The artificial intelligence algorithms have no idea what you're asking or what they're answering. They simply collected a large group of sentences and rules without understanding them of how you stick them together. So they're just kind of re-sticking words in a somewhat proper way. So you shouldn't really assume that they kind of know almost anything, because artificial intelligence hallucinates, it makes stuff up, it lies, it confuses, and it could be a lot of trouble. There's some service that offered to use an artificial intelligence engine. You would submit food products that you have available, and it would give you a recipe. And eventually someone actually made some of the stuff, and most of it was totally unpalatable because artificial algorithms don't know how to cook or mix things. And some of the times they picked things that were poisonous. So, artificial intelligence has a great possibility in the future, and it scares everyone, I know. But right now, it's not quite ready for prime time.
Well, Dr. Roy, I just want to say that my video program, my photo editing software, my photography, creating photos as fine art, they're coming up with more and more features that incorporate artificial intelligence for the quality of the resolution and different kinds of imaging. Go ahead.
Yes, by the way, AC2GS, I'm well aware. I have a lot of that that I use and play with. There's artificial intelligence supposedly running speech synthesizers so that you can synthesize particular speeches. I've tried to make copies of my own speech synthesized and such. I have an Adobe Photoshop that will extend backgrounds and create new backgrounds. But there's always little glitches so far, and they might fix the glitches, and they might be exceptional in the future. But to this day, if you have an artificial intelligence draw you a picture of a person, for some strange reason, they very seldom have five fingers. They'll have three fingers. They'll have seven fingers. I don't exactly know what's wrong with the general generative algorithm that they use, but it's rather rare that you get people with good hands on the sides of their body. They're going off at strange angles, and they don't quite have the same number of digits that they should.
U.S. to West.
Well, yes, I have to say that there are online applications that you can access that are designed for business, and you can tell the person what to say, and you can pick what person is going to say it. And I guess for for a meeting or for some kind of commercials, it looks very interesting, but won't people get tired of all the same faces, repeating themselves from one commercial to the other?
Well, by the way, Paul recognized you. You doubled with David. Doubled with you, but we'll get to you in a second. There's all kinds of things. There's services out there where you can send a script, and an actual human being will recite it. There's software that's text to voice, and you can buy speech modules. In the old days, they were close to decent, but not quite that good. They're making them relatively much better now. I have a service called 11 Labs, which offers 20, 30 different standard high-res synthetic voices with inflection and all kinds of things, which if you study and listen a long time, you recognize that they're a little bit off, but you have to really focus to do that. And they also offer services. You can send them a couple, 3-4 minutes of a person's voice, and they'll give you something relatively close to that voice synthesized. They're offering a more sophisticated version. If you can wait long enough, it required me, I submitted 3 hours of TechNet monologue for myself, and I'll see how good it is, and if it's good, I'll share it with the audience. But, you know, there's all kinds of different ways. You know, they'll get better over time, but unfortunately, we've reached a little speed bump, and apparently the obsession is a little bit down, the use is down, and these companies that have been burning money have been starting to run out of it. So, you know, it's time for a little retrenchment. Paul, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, in regard to the AI topic, I brought this up on a computer net. There's this physicist, a theoretical physicist, you know, he comes out of New York, Michio Kaku. You've probably seen him on TV a million times, because he's not a kid anymore. He's getting older. But he said that this ChatGPT and the other ones that are out there now are nothing but glorified tape recorders. He says he pretty much said what you said before. It's grabbing all kinds of little bits of information from the internet from the last 20 years that's out there, and collecting it and just putting it together. It's not really thinking. He says the only time you're going to get a computer that might get close to the idea of actually thinking is when they could develop the quantum computers. Maybe that might have a shot, but not what's going on right now. Anyway, back to you, Rick.
Okay. Well, to a degree, I disagree with him. Quantum computers are capable of doing specific subset of things much more efficiently. If you're going to break the product of two prime numbers, which is the encryption method that's used all the time on the internet, then a quantum computer is well suited, because as we've talked before, there's things called superposition, in which these bits can occupy both a one and a zero simultaneously, and then you collapse the probability function and you get the answer. So in those cases, great. In the cases of artificial intelligence, probably not. There's not that much quantum mechanics, thankfully, going on in our brain. It's more of a very complex series of interacting nodes that increase sensitivity and decrease sensitivity, that are positive and negative feedback, that's trained over a long period of development and such. So eventually they're working on neural networks, which is not at all the same as quantum mechanics, and perhaps when the number of neural network nodes approach anything close to build will be capable of thought. Right now, I would agree, though, that these expressions on these artificial intelligence are very, very clever tricks. And especially, you can't trust them. They do lie a great deal. They don't mean to lie. They don't know what they're doing. It's, again, there's no conscious mind on the other side of the terminal. It's just a very sophisticated series of algorithms and an enormous database of written speech.
He claims quantum computing, says in his latest book, could change the course of history. He says the quantum computers are the closest approximation of human brain processing power. He's going with that. But, he's not happy about what everybody is saying on the news. When you put the news on, and he says people are saying, "Oh, look, it's thinking. It's almost human." He says it's nothing but pieces of the internet all being jammed together. anyway, but, you know, we'll see. I don't think we're, what is it, about 20 years off? What's going to come first? A computer that thinks like a human or fusion power, Roy?
Well, unfortunately, I would probably tell you that artificial intelligence will come first, because I think that fusion power is going to be 20 years in our future for probably another century or two. Unfortunately, I would prefer it not to, but, yeah. Well, the problem, once again, Michio Kaku is a brilliant theoretical physicist. He is not a brilliant neurophysiologist. So you got to understand, and I understand that, you know, most people see a guy who's very smart in a field and figures that, well, if he's smart in that field, he's probably smart in every field. So, yeah, whatever. Yeah, sure. He's not a neurophysiologist. I assume, based on the fact that he's pushing quantum computing for neural node computations, that he doesn't know anything about neural node computations. So, you know, popular books are interesting. Usually they're filled with semi-nonsense. I've discussed in the past that Stephen Hawking, who was a genius, basically lied about one of his important findings of Hawking radiation, because I think his publisher told him that if he tried to explain it to the average person, they'd just get a headache. So he made up a fairy tale. So I don't know exactly why Michio Kaku is promoting quantum computers are going to be very useful if they are ever actually built to the specs that people are theorizing. All the encryption technology of the internet will be broken. All the banking software will be useless. It will wreak havoc upon this world. Everyone will have to figure out another sophisticated encryption algorithm that can't be broken by quantum computers. So it's going to have a heck of an impact. It's going to be worse than the 1999-2000 problem that we had.
Is it possible for robots to communicate on a ham radio?
Robots are just a mechanical object. You still need some kind of artificial intelligence to have them do something, unless you just want to run them by remote control.
Well, you know, think about it this way. You got bots on social media. They somehow communicate. Somehow they gather data, you know. And, you know, if you have a station somewhere, a computer, that has the ability to have a conversation, and that's set up through a remote ham radio station, you know, and somehow, you know, the intelligence is able to control the ham radio station, people can communicate as bots.
Well, but ultimately, then you're just operating remotely, and people do that all the time. Bots are nothing particularly special. One of the earliest pieces of software out there was something called Eliza, which was a text-based responsive program. You know, you'd say, "Hello, Eliza, how are you?" And you would get back an output that said, "I am fine, how are you?" Because it had a lot of if-then branch points, and it was cleverly designed to respond to, you know, the usual question and answers, and it had a few get-out-of-jail responses like, "What did you say? I didn't quite hear you. I didn't understand you," or what have you, to kind of mimic conscious thought. So there have been computer programming tricks to simulate a consciousness. There's something called the Turing test, which is basically you type in and out to a computer and or a person on a terminal someplace else, and you have to kind of figure out how many times you can say something to this computer and get a response before you figure out if it's either a human being or if it's a computer robot or it's a psychotic. Because unfortunately, sometimes psychotic responses are very similar to the ones that bots produce.
QSL, QSL. But, you know, how to say? It is possible for a machine to simulate a ham radio conversation, and I don't know if I would put my time into that. I think I'd rather just make QSOs and have a good time.
Well, it depends on the individual. You can do a lot of different things. I thought of possibly putting ChatGPT here on the technical desk. I have figured a way of routing the audio in and out where it will recognize relatively low noise speech, translate it into text, and then produce an answer, and then translate that into synthesized voice. I wasn't quite sure if people were interested in that sort of thing, but it's capable, it's possible to do such things, and I'm sure people have done it. You don't really need robots to control radios. You can have a computer do it on a level of signals, just because of the old CIV and protocols, ASCII's and USB connectors and such. So there are lots of programs that remotely operate radios. Therefore, we talked about FT8. There's a program that kind of automates contacts with FT8. So you set it to the side, and it'll send out CQs, and it'll reply to other CQs. It'll keep a track of it all and dump it into your CSV list of contacts, and it'll probably even send it out to the authorities to get a Worked All States award. So there's a lot of automated things going on.
QSL Roy, thank you very much. I want to thank you, and also I want to thank everybody in the TechNet. Hope you have a fantastic night. KG2RY.
Okay, very good, David. Thank you for participating. Before Craig has to go to bed, if anyone has any experience wiring up a Tucson Hyundai, especially a 2023 model, he would really like to know your experiences. Okay, I thought I'd give it a try. Once again, I'm AC2GS. This is the Limewalk Technical Net. And we're here for questions or comments or topics of interest. I was hoping to hear Ed WB2EAV out there. Ed, are you around tonight?
Yeah, let me take my position on
here, WB2EAV. Okay, we'll wait for you. No problem. Yes, Alex.
If I want to pay somebody to install a radio, can any car stereo place do it in the city, or do I have to go to like a taxi place?
Well, I think it depends upon whether you have esoteric requirements. I think if it's as simple as a 2 meter, 70 centimeter mobile radio, any place that puts in regular radios could figure that out. You know, if you're a little bit more esoteric and you want to do HF, and 40 meters, and you need a big whip, and you want to run more than 100 watts, then you might need some special expertise. But, you know, if you keep it simple, I think they should be able to handle it. You know, let your fingers do the walking through the yellow pages, you know, call up a bunch of places and see what they have to say. I think they'd go for it personally.
Do I need anything special to get the current up to 100 watts? Can a car battery do 100 watts without a separate little box you buy and attach to it?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately it depends on the car. There are cars with a lot of extra oomph, and there are cars that are just working on fumes. You know, there are guys out there who think nothing of running 2 kilowatts. They have a second distributor. They have a generator that's operating under the hood and such. That's really requires a lot more finesse. I don't know if it's terribly beneficial to operate above 100 watts mobile. A lot of guys with a base station work 100 watts and never go higher. So is it doable? Yeah. Does it require a lot more finicky stuff? Yeah, it does.
WB2EAV.
Yes, Ed. Good to hear you again. So, Alex, any other comments?
No, I have a comment for Alex.
Oh, great. Please do.
The key thing to be aware of is not the battery, but the wiring. If you're talking about 100 watts RF out, you're probably drawing more like 200 watts from the battery. Which is a decent slug of current, so you need some fairly heavy gauge wire and a good installation.
Okay, that's a good point, Ted.
Another point. I have been able to use a cigarette lighter jack at 50 watts with no issues at all, but I'd be very leery about going above that.
Yeah, I could understand that, but don't you think it's somewhat a matter of what car model, what year, what condition the cigarette lighter connector is in? It's kind of a little bit of a game of Russian roulette.
I think these days, cars don't even have them anymore. They have USB jacks, which is a totally different ballgame. But I don't think it's that random. I think, in general, a cigarette lighter jack is good for about 100 watts, which is good for a 50-watt rig, but I wouldn't go above that. And if you're going above that, you're probably going to, you know, want to run some, like, 12-gauge wire right to the battery or something.
Yeah, I think if you can run the wires to the battery, you're better off running them. You know, you never quite know if there's some corrosion on those wires. That they might be, and yeah, as you pointed out, most people don't use them to light cigarettes, so they're not really in use. So it's not like, someone popped it in and started to smell smoke or something. So you're just trying it out from nothing, and there's got to be some non-zero failure rate in any technology. So if you're unlucky, you're the guy that it failed in. So I don't know. If you have to use power, best to draw it straight from the battery with the thickest wires you can afford.
The US-2N.
Yes, Paul.
I haven't bought a new radio in a long time, but, you know, my old Kenwood HF, when you buy it, it came with wires, to, you know, if you wanted to hook up to the car. You know, it came, you know, it both, you know, you plug it into your power supply, and then a set of wires that you would plug into the back of the radio, and then two fuses on there, both on the negative and on the positive side, and they 12-gauge wire, you know, and That's the way it was designed. Heavy duty. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I think I've had radios, and I've only had radios for 11 years. It came just like that, with fuses on both sides for mobile installation. Yeah, I think that's the best bet. Again, you get away with things until you don't get away with them anymore. So, yeah, I'm sure there's lots of people who have them plugged into old cars. Lighters. I kind of agree with Ed that I'm sure modern cars have given up the ghost as far as lighter they just have USB connections and such for all the toys that people like to bring into the car.
KD2VHD.
Yes, VHD.
Hello, Roy. This is Jim. I want to make a comment on the modern changes to the cars, if I may.
Certainly, Jim.
The good advice of hooking the power leads to a high-powered ham radio to the battery is not relevant to many of the modern cars because of the computer being so much more involved in the electrical management. I think it started mostly when they started going to fully electric power steering and has much more critical needs for power than most of the other accessories used to. So there's voltage sensing going on at the battery that is very important to make the system run properly. And often that now they have a separate terminal somewhere where you can tap into that effectively gives you straight to the battery, but it's past the sensor, so you don't affect the electrical system. So people should be aware of that new development on cars for the last almost a decade.
Okay, very good. Thank you for that. That's useful information.
You're welcome. Back to that.
Okay. Alex, any further comments?
How often do people run their battery down by talking on the radio too much while they're in the car? Does it help to put a more beefcake battery in the car? I drove a Subaru Outback 2016, 82DU.
Okay, I'll ask the audience out there. I mean, I it's never good practice to operate your transmitter when the car is idle. You know, you just turned it on and it's parked and you're sitting there because you're just going to drain the battery. If you drive in the car, you got the generator running, and hopefully the generator will make up for any of the power requirements, and you're not going to bottom out your starter battery. But if people have more enlightened answers, then please feel free to hit that push to talk.
I have some thoughts, WB2EAV.
Certainly, Ed.
Basically, Roy, I do agree with you that you don't want to play that game too much. On the other hand, if you just want to use your radio for a couple of minutes with a little bit of transmission, no problem. A typical car battery is about 70 amp hours. So, you know, that's a fair amount. It would take a fair amount to run it down. But, you know, the stakes are pretty high. You really don't want to play that game, particularly if you're in some obscure place where you might have trouble getting your battery boost to get it restarted. But as general as that, and also one point, Roy, just to be an annoying purist, these days cars technically don't have generators, they have alternators, although between you and me and the lamppost, to me a generator is something that generates electricity. But everybody tells me, no, I'm wrong, it's an alternator, which is basically an AC, an AC generator and diodes.
Okay, I understand. The English language has its nuances.
Well, I will tell you, in a power plant of any kind, it's called a generator, even though it's three-phase AC.
Well, yeah, and I mean, on field day, we all run around with these Honda units. They pump out AC, and we all call them generators. I don't remember anyone calling, saying, I got to get my alternator fixed when they're talking about their Honda generators.
I guess the answer is no one ever said it makes sense.
Well, yeah, I, again, that's language in, top to bottom. There's a lot of problems. It's, you know, anything you have an infinite number of engineers, being anyone who can talk, involved in building it and changing it, you're going to have a lot of strange add-ons to the side that are going to make absolutely no sense.
Anyway, should we check that we answer the gentleman's question?
Okay, what do you say, Alex?
Yeah, that was all helpful. I definitely think that I'm going to try to pay someone to do this instead of, like, monkeying around with my own car battery. But this added a bit of color. Thank you.
Okay, very good. I wish you all the luck. Come back and tell us how it worked out for you.
Yeah, you'll hear me just driving around yelling at you. That's how you know.
Okay, I'll keep the window open. Okay, this is once again AC2GS. So, Ed, do you want to discuss what we were exchanging emails about earlier this week?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But full disclosure, I have to point out this has nothing to do with ham radio.
Hopefully I'm there. Like I said, there's a little wonky with the switch to trigger the All-Star. We often talk about non-amateur radio subjects, and last Sunday at about 8:05, I did a short presentation on fusion technology and discussed, I brought up the subject of tritium. So if we could do it at 8:05 or 8:10, we can certainly do it at 9:44.
All right, so should I jump in?
Certainly.
All right, apparently, Indian Point nuclear power plant was shut down in a move that I think was sanity on the part of then-Governor Cuomo, because basically they took, in this day and age of everybody trying to get as far from fossil fuel as possible, we took a nuclear power plant offline and have replaced it with fossil fuel generated electricity, primarily from burning fracked natural gas out of Pennsylvania, so that not only are we burning more fossil fuels when we didn't have to, but the cost of the raw fuel goes to Pennsylvania, not New York. But in any event, as part of the demolition, there was a question about getting rid of the water in the spent fuel pools. Am I doing all right, Roy?
Yep, doing great.
Now, nuclear power plants always are basically generating wastewater, which has some amount of tritium in it coming from the nuclear reactions. And this has been going on since day one. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the UN's International Atomic Energy Association have come up with very, very specific rules for how to do this. And the bottom line is there is a noise floor, to steal a term from radio, of tritium and water. Cosmic rays in the upper atmosphere do generate a steady flow of tritium, and it has a half-life of roughly 12 years. So it's kind of achieved a constant level, a noise floor, as you are, of one hydrogen atom out of every 10 to the 18, which I've checked is a quintillion, or billion, trillion, quadrillion, quintillion, is tritium, and it is a measurable level of radioactivity. And every drop of water on this planet has that level. And the NRC and IAEA regulations say, well, the water you're going to dilute your stuff with has this level, so you certainly can't go below that. So they have rules and regulations of how much above the baseline level you can go, and you have to dilute it with outside water, and then you can put it into major rivers or the ocean. And the exact ratio of how much above the baseline you can go depends on whether it's going into a river, how big a river, or the ocean. Okay, Roy?
Yeah, clear.
Well, with the dismantling of Indian Point, it became totally hysterical, where a lot of people were screaming that they want to pollute the Hudson River. It took us decades to get it cleaned up. Now they're just dumping stuff again, ignoring the fact that there are very well understood regulations that have been used and followed and enforced all over the world for decades. And a batch of people started saying, no, we cannot tolerate any tritium at all being put in the Hudson River, considering the water coming out of your tap is one part, 10 to the 18th, tritium. So there's no way of going below that, and they don't care. So the governor of New York today, Hochul, the other day signed a law saying you cannot put any tritium into the Hudson River. And the alternative is they will truck 1 million gallons of water. Think about how many truckloads that is. To another state where they will dump it into another river.
Sort of a case of not in my river.
Let me remind you, all major rivers tend to go to the ocean, the same ocean.
K2SCP.
Yes, Chris?
Thanks, Roy. I just wanted to bring up that I have a bunch of tritium on my wrist. I'm looking at it right now. I wear Luminox watches. That's a brand of a watch, Luminox, if you look it up. They're given to you in military for pilots and whatnot. 12 little vials of tritium around it. I'm sure you're aware of that, what they are, Roy. Borosilicate glass, little tiny vials, and they're put around the outside of the watch to light it up, and it's lit for 20 years. So basically, I'm walking around with a little radiation on my wrist, but I've worn them for 40, 50 years now. I love tritium. Just wanted to bring that up. K2SDP.
I have a silicon.
Okay, sir. Okay, Ed, please, give us your silly comment, and then I'll give you my silly comment.
You're fine, just so long as you don't try swimming in the Hudson River with it, because now you're violating the law if you do. Roy?
Okay. I was going to mention that, like, I think I've mentioned before, I have all kinds of little gadgets and gizmos. I have one of those drinking birds on my desk. I had the diamagnetic display on my desk. I also have a little vial of tritium, probably a bigger vial than one of Chris's, but probably he makes up for it in the volume. With tritium, if it's encased, it should be completely harmless. It gives off beta particles that get blocked by anything and everything. The problem with tritium is if you either inhale it or if you swallow it, then it's close enough for the decay products to wreak all kinds of unfortunate havoc. So, you know, as long as you respect the tritium, it's not that problematic. But the problem with people is science has learned how to detect ridiculously small concentrations of anything, and so it scares the public, because although everything is adulterated with everything else, if you didn't know about it, it wouldn't bother you. You know, you start to talk to people that there is a government minimum amount of insect parts in chocolate, they get very anxious and want you to tell them that you were kidding them or something. So, you know, it's another case of these people who mean well but don't understand anything, where they don't want any radiation. Well, you can't live in a world that has no radiation. Our bananas have radioactive potassium-40 decaying and producing positrons in our stomach. You know, you can't get away with it. There's no such place. But, you know, I think different... well, let me drop for a sec.
I have another point.
Okay, I just want to finish up on one point before I totally forget about it. And, you know, that's the fact that these people don't quite know... There's different people with different arguments. There's the idiot who says he doesn't want any radiation. He's just an idiot. Then there are guys who said, I don't like the federal guidelines for tritium. I like the Californian ones. Now, if you use the Californian ones, you got problems with getting rid of the water because it would be more than they would allow in California, but this is New York. So, you know, different people with different arguments. I think I mentioned to you one guy had a wonderful idea. Just keep it in the pool for another 12 years. It'll have half the radioactivity. It'll be below California's present standard, and then he wouldn't mind, apparently, that you flushed it into the river, except that where it's sitting, it's being recharged with tritium. So in 12 years, instead of having half the tritium, you'll probably have twice the amount of tritium. Again, people who slept during their science courses, apparently. So on to you, Ed.
Isn't just radioactivity. Almonds, the nuts, have some cyanide in them. So the idea being, it's a matter of whether, not whether or not there is an absolute yes or no, is it in there? It is a matter of how much. Everything in this game is how much. And also, I don't know yet if they have removed the spent fuel from the spent fuel pools at Indian Point. If they have removed the spent fuel, I believe it will begin to decay at a 12-year half-life. But again, in 12 years, it's only half, so it might need a slightly different, you know, regulation, but it's not really a significant drop.
Well, I don't know exactly what California's standard is. I think the federal standard is something like 900 curies total per year, and I think they estimate that this would flood 500 curies total into the river, and so my assumption is that California's probably below 500. I don't know for a fact, but some articles I've read suggest strongly that the pools still have nuclear material, so they would charge up the tritium instead of allowing it to decay away over time. unless they cleaned up those pools.
I do know that Indian Point, what they were doing is they were taking the older spent fuel, taking it out of the pool, and putting in the steel and concrete caps. In other words, it had cooled down enough, it did not have to be submerged. And they had some of these casks on site. And supposedly, they're not especially hot, but it is noticeable that when it snows, there's no snow on them.
Yeah, I'm sure it frightens the people out there. Yeah, radiation is a word that scares so many different people. Way back, I think in the 60s, they started to sterilize food products by radiating them, and I don't think they had made any law requiring them to mention it to anyone. So there's a lot of things that we eat that have been exposed to radioactive material to basically sterilize it, and I guess it's a good thing that they don't know about it, because otherwise there'd be a lot of angry people protesting that too.
Well, here's the question. What's the alternative?
I'm sure there are other more expensive technologies that would sterilize it. It's just that exposing it to radioactive particles for a short period of time doesn't leave any residual radioactivity and kills most organic compounds, so most organisms. So I'm sure there's got to be other ways. They might not be as non-deleterious to the food, you know. You could heat it up, but that kind of can cause problems. You can expose it to UV, but that's only a surface effect. Under the surface, you still have microorganisms. So I'm sure there's other methods. It's just this is very quick, easy, cheap, and invisible to everyone.
K2SCP.
Yes, Chris.
So I've had this question for a while since we're talking tritium. Tritium has gone up extremely, maybe 5 or 10 times the price in the last maybe 5 years or so. Those little vials, you can buy them on eBay or whatever. In fact, they used to be difficult to get because of the federal regulations for it, but somehow that got loosened up and it's for sale everywhere. But those little vials have increased in price like tenfold, and apparently there's a shortage similar to helium on tritium to make these vials or anything else, watches, whatever they use it for. I'm wondering, is the stuff from the nuclear waste plants, or from the nuclear plants, the waste, is that the same exact tritium that they could take out of that water and use for as tritium for sale for things, or is that too difficult to do? I know they get it from nuclear reactors somehow, but I think they're designed to get it from them. Is the regular waste from nuclear plants different from the plants that they actually make the tritium at? Or how do they get it? Let's put it that way.
I tend to think that the waste is a much lower concentration of tritium. It's incredibly difficult to separate tritium from hydrogen water because they're almost identical. There's a weight difference, but you'd have to use centrifuges. It would be incredibly costly to separate them. They do separate the heavy radioactive materials out of the water, so that tends not to be the problem. But when it gets down to things like tritium, it's just not cost-effective to be able to concentrate it that much.
Gotcha. Understood. All right. So I shouldn't go out and invest in a couple barrels of this wastewater in my basement to try to make some tritium vials? I take it.
No, I don't think so, although that would be an interesting thing. You know, get a supply and try and sell it on eBay. I'm sure there's you know, if there's still people buying NFTs and crypto coins, I'm sure there's a market in them. And, you know, I would say kind of save it up, but unfortunately, as we mentioned earlier, tritium has a half-life of a little bit over, I think it's 12.3 years, and so, you know, you end up losing money unless the price keeps climbing up. And I think the price is climbing up because they're decommissioning all these breeder reactors that they were getting it from. So the supply is tightening ever so tighter.